100 days into the presidency of Joe Biden, are we seeing the beginning of a transformative era, or is it business as usual? I'll ask one of the country's most outspoken progressive politicians. I'm Mark Lamont Hill. Also on the show, the absolute devastation caused by COVID-19 in India has shocked the world. But could it be even worse than it appears? I'll talk to a Mumbai-based investigative journalist who says the government is hiding the real numbers. But first, it's been 100 days since Joe Biden took office, and the U.S. president is being painted as a progressive hero. But is he really a visionary, or is he just not Donald Trump? This week's headliner, former Ohio State Senator and co-chair of Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, Nina Turner. Nina Turner, thank you for joining me on Upfront. When President Biden ran for office, he said that he would be the most progressive president in American history. Now, we're just 100 days in, and people are already making comparisons to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, and LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who introduced some of the most sweeping progressive reforms in American history. We're talking about somebody who basically was the architect of the crime bill, someone who helped push us into Iraq, someone who bailed out Wall Street in 2008. Is it even possible for someone with that history to be mentioned in the conversation around progressive presidents?
Well, what I will say is that this is certainly the beginning of the process here. I will say that the Biden administration, because of the push of the progressive movement, we can't lose sight of the fact that the progressive movement, all of these things are brought to you by the progressive movement. The push and some of the things that we heard last night is because the progressive movement is out there making these demands. I think the first 100 days are just that. We got a long way to go, because what you are naming, the things that you just enumerated, those things were put into place by policies that he supported. And so now he is the president of the United States of America, and this provides him a spectacular opportunity through public policy to undo some of that damage. And some of that, especially on the crime bill, had generational impacts. So it's a great time to be able to undo some of those things. But pushing for family paid medical leave, family leave and medical leave for up to 12 weeks when we have zero and other industrialized nations are ahead of us on that is a good thing. Talking about infrastructure is, all of those things are a good thing. But when you are on the path to good, you got to keep going. And in some cases, we got to run like our lives depended on it. So this is a startup process. It's not the beginning. Hence the first 100 days. We got many more days to go.
You mentioned last night, of course, you're referencing at the time of this interview to President Biden's speech before the joint session of the U.S. Congress. He talked about his agenda. One of the things that came up in that was his American Families Plan. He talked about his plan for the economy. He talked about a lot of stuff. As you said, some of it is a result of being pushed by the progressive movement. But have we set too low a bar for him? Are we measuring him against the progressive movement, or are we measuring him against Trump, who left it a fairly low bar to measure against?
I mean, you're bringing up a great point. The country, or at least part of the country, because let us not forget that Mr. Trump did amass 74 million votes. So let's just say the other half of the country was very fatigued by President Trump. The world was fatigued by President Trump. And so I will give President Biden credit in terms of his very presence changes that dynamic, that we are no longer dealing with a neo-fascist, to be sure. And neo-fascism had to be dealt with up front. But now that we are in this moment, that Democrats control all the levers of power that they asked for, so now is the opportunity for the Democratic Party to go bold, to go big. And this is no time to shrink. Power must be used. It does not last always, and so you must use it.
Now, you say we got rid of the neo-fascist president. Many would argue, but we have a neoliberal president, someone who still worships the market, someone who still doesn't really believe in the kind of socialized response to suffering that many people would advocate for on your side of the aisle. If that's the case, is Biden the person to lead a progressive movement? Can he do that?
Well, it's not about him leading the progressive movement. I mean, he is who he is. But what he has shown thus far, in his administration thus far, that they are listening and capturing the pulse somewhat. Congress right now, they got to do what they need to do on the inside, and then we need the outside leaders to continue to push and have the courage to ask for more. That's the key. We're not going to settle. You got to have the courage to ask more. And you can also say that somebody's moving in the right direction. Those things are not mutually exclusive. We're going to acknowledge some things and then have the courage to ask for more.
One place I'm wondering is, are we moving in the right direction on immigration? Biden is continuing mass deportations at the U.S. border by continuing the Trump-era Title 42 policy, one of the most restricted immigration policies ever implemented. It's now being used to expel hundreds of thousands of immigrants at the border, including families and children. Now, the Democrats have called it racist and short-sighted, but now the Biden administration is using it to deport people en masse, particularly people from Haiti, for example. There were 100,000 expulsions in March. When you compare apples to apples, month to month, that's just as much, if not more, than Trump during that time. How can Democrats in general, not just Biden, but Democrats in general, claim any high ground on this issue now?
Sure. Well, we can't at this moment on that. I can't mince words there on that. We can't. And our Haitian sisters and brothers in particular, and other of our sisters and brothers from the Black diaspora, are not treated the same. There are many immigration reports and studies that show that there is a racialized and anti-Blackness, if you will, when it comes to the immigration of our Black sisters and brothers from the diaspora, and particularly Haiti. And that is a problem, and it must be fixed. So again, Democrats have a tremendous responsibility and an incredible opportunity to make things right. And in that particular area, we are not doing that. It's not being done in this moment. But that doesn't mean that the way that it is right now is the way that it has to continue to be. So we must push on that as well.
Let's move to another issue that President Biden probably doesn't, in fact, certainly doesn't see eye to eye with you and many other progressives on, and that's the defund the police movement. He has, again, just like with Medicare for All, just like with the Green New Deal, President Biden has said, I don't support the defund the police movement. You have been very vocal in support of it. Given that, how optimistic or hopeful are you that this can actually be a plan that is put into place?
There is no doubt that we must address the white supremacy, the anti-Blackness, and the caste system, not just within policing in America, but in every single facet of American society. And what we see happening through in law enforcement right now with the killings and shootings of unarmed people, particularly unarmed Black men, is a reckoning of unfinished business in the United States of America. So the Department of Justice should investigate all police-related shootings, period. That should be the policy. That should be the way that the administration acts, bar none. Connecting and putting demands on any funding that goes to police departments or law enforcement agencies in the United States of America. So that those are some things that can happen on the federal. Oh, and let's demilitarize. Now, I will say I have family members who are in law enforcement or have been in law enforcement. So I do understand this from multiple lenses. I get it. I will say this finally on this point. There is good, tremendous good in human nature, and there's also tremendous evil in human nature. So we would be naive to say that we don't need police. We do need police. But what people are asking for, particularly the Black community, is to be treated with dignity and respect, and for police officers not to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. That must happen, and those types of policies have to be pushed not just on the federal level, but also on the state level where I serve, and also the local levels of government as well.
Let me push you on that just for a second. So if we can reimagine the system, why can't we reimagine abolition?
I mean, I'm not saying that we cannot reimagine that. Yeah, let's have the conversation. But on the other end of that, we do have to admit that there are some people in society where police are necessary. You know, when I think about babies who have been killed by drive-bys, you know, my heart aches with that. You know, I served as a Cleveland City Councilwoman, and there was a situation where a skirmish happened at a park, And the people part of that took it to the streets where kids were riding bicycles and doing hopscotch and shot through a house and shot two young children under the age of six. So for me to be naive and to say that there is not some need to have policing, that's not it. But it is the way that police are socialized in this country that is the problem, and also the total disregard and disrespect for Black lives that was built into the system from the beginning.
The other day, during his address to the joint session of Congress, President Biden said that the middle class built this country. What say you?
Working poor built this country. Look, I'm not going to separate the middle class and the working poor. I'm not sure what he means by the middle class, but what I will say is that working people built this country. And if I were to go even further than that, historically, we know who truly built this country. The hegemonic nature of this country came on the backs of chattel slavery. That is real, and we must deal with that. As we progressed as a nation, working class people built this country. And you know what? Middle class people work. I mean, we separate. I don't like the separation. Let's just go ahead and put all working people together. Is somebody in the middle of that? Yes. Is somebody at the top of that? Yes. Is somebody at the bottom? But it is working everyday people, and they get in a raw deal. Let's increase the minimum wage. Let's make sure that we have universal health care in this country that would give relief to everybody in this country, and will also help our businesses. There are lots of big and bold policies that we can do as a hegemon nation, and we must do it. Bold and big, quickly.
You were the national campaign co-chair for Bernie Sanders, who pointed out that 2 years after Obama took office, Republicans, quote, did phenomenally well. The same was true after 2 years under Clinton. He says it's because Democrats failed to use their power to benefit working families, but that Biden understands this. You're running for Congress this year, hoping to represent the 11th district in Ohio, a state that Donald Trump comfortably won. Do you think Biden has done enough for working families, enough that Democrats could pick up congressional seats based on his record?
Well, we lost a seat because of the census. You know, that's happening right now in Ohio. So in 2022, we will have one less seat. And so what I am running to do is to keep this movement going in the Congress, because I do have the courage to ask for more. One in every three children in my district are living in poverty. Many families are living in poverty. This is a district that has extraordinary wealth on one end and extreme poverty on the other. And so for the working side of my district, the poorest people in this district, they need a $15 an hour minimum wage increase. We got to do that. And can't blame a parliamentarian. Let's just go ahead and get that done. They need universal health care.
But have Democrats done enough to get those? Because the argument here is that Democrats win, they don't serve the working people, and so then they look to Republicans as an alternative. Have Democrats, and particularly the Biden administration, done enough now so that they'll look to Democrats to pick up these seats, as opposed to saying, you know what, let's try this Republican way again?
Well, we got to continue to earn that. I mean, my state, you're right, not only did President Trump win in 2020, he increased his lead in 2020. We got to speak the love language of the working class people of not just the great state of Ohio, but all over the country. And we can do that because we control all the levers there. And there's more work to be done. And I'm laying out that work: $15 an hour minimum wage, universal health care, Medicare for all, and canceling student debt so that we can get people disposable income in their pockets. We can do it. We have the levers of power. We cannot waste that power. When Republicans are in power, they use it. And so I want to see my Democratic colleagues, and I will be there to join them, to continue to have the courage to ask for more, to use that power in such a way that we leave no doubt whose side the Democratic Party is on.
Nina Turner, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you for having me.
A devastating wave of COVID-19 infections is overwhelming India. Hospitals and crematoriums are overflowing with bodies, and an untold number of people are scrambling for oxygen cylinders, medicines, and hospital beds. India has become the epicenter of the global pandemic, with more than 1 in 3 new cases in the world now in the country, and over 3,000 deaths a day. But that's just the official count, and many believe the real numbers are far higher. So what accounts for this devastation, and how did India get to this point? To help us answer this, we're joined by Rana Ayub, an investigative journalist based in Mumbai and a global opinions writer for The Washington Post. Rana, thank you for joining me on Upfront. You've covered so many things. You've covered the devastating impact of anti-poor policies on Indians. You have covered, of course, religious-based riots. You've covered extrajudicial killings. And, of course, the first wave of COVID-19 in the country. And yet, despite all of that, you write in Time magazine last week of the current situation, if the apocalypse had an image, it would be the hospitals of India. What makes this circumstance worse than anything you've seen before?
Well, Mark, I've been reporting for the last 15 years, but I've never, and I've seen, of course, Narendra Modi's own governance of the Gujarat carnage in the year 2002 as a relief worker. But what he's doing to the country right now, when it is devastation, it is like a writer friend said last evening, it's a holocaust. Where the Prime Minister has criminally abdicated his responsibility when the second wave of COVID-19 has been devastating Indians, has ravaged the rest of the country, and the Prime Minister is fixated with elections in the country, stretching it to 8 phases all over West Bengal and Assam, from where we are recording the highest number of cases in the last 1 or 2 weeks. The hospitals resemble a war zone. Our crematoriums are so full that the rich are trying to use their contacts to book a slot in the crematorium because they're all booked for the next 3 days. There is no wood left to light the pyres. There's only enough wood for the next 2 or 3 days. There are more bodies than wood. And of course, it's the devastation. The Indian government is trying to hide as usual. It is camouflaging the figures because it believes there will be a backlash. And of course, there will be a backlash because this year, we thought the country would have been better prepared. And especially when there were warnings by specialists, by doctors, by epidemiologists, that the second wave could be devastating for the country. The Prime Minister paid no heed, and which is why we are where we are. I have never, as a journalist, witnessed devastation at this scale pan-India.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some of those numbers, because at the beginning of April, we were seeing 80,000 cases and less than 500 deaths on the first day of April, to now where we see 350,000 cases and 3,000 deaths a day.
Yeah.
And of course, as you talked about, some crematoriums, journalists have documented that the body counts there exceed the death toll, which suggests that the numbers simply aren't accurate. You know, metal grills used to burn bodies have melted down from overuse. We don't even have our minds completely wrapped around how big of a crisis we're facing based on the official numbers. Do you have a sense of just how big the numbers could be?
When I wrote this Time magazine piece, Mark, 4 days ago, there was an estimate that the death figures, this estimate came from my conversations with journalists, health officials, doctors across the country. And I said the estimated number could be about 10,000 in a day. In the last 3 days, I've been speaking to journalists, I've been speaking to a lot of people in rural India, including my own family members, my entire ancestral family in Azamgarh, which is in the largest state of Uttar Pradesh. The entire family is COVID positive. My uncle is critical on ventilator. And when I spoke to a lot of doctors, the figures so far come to about 20,000 deaths in a day. A journalist sent me a video from a crematorium, and he says close to 200 bodies are being cremated at one single cremation ground in a small city of Uttar Pradesh. One can only imagine what the scale of the devastation will be across the country. It is at least 10 times more than the official numbers this government is out
there. 10 times more. I mean, and again, we don't have official records. There's no official data collection here. Would you say then that the government is invested in keeping the COVID death numbers low for its own political interests?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The government is invested in doing that because the government knows that it has behaved in a manner which is criminal. The Indian Medical Association yesterday called Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, as the super spreader of the virus in the country. The Madras High Court has called the Election Commission of India, which allowed Narendra Modi, which was in cahoots with Narendra Modi, for the 8th phase election, as the High Court has said that the Election Commission should be charged with murder. Now, that's a very, very serious remark from the judiciary in India. And that goes to prove that the government knows that it's going to receive a backlash, which is why it's trying to hide the numbers. There is a reason why the health minister of this country took a press conference just to tell people that the mortality rate is only 0.2%. If that is the case, why is the government trying to delete information from social media? Why has it asked Twitter to delete tweets that speak about the number of deaths? Why has the chief minister of the largest state in India, Yogi Adityanath, asked for arresting those people who talk about oxygen shortage or the number of deaths on social media? There is a paranoia. There is a paranoia that the government does not want to reveal the real numbers. There's no transparency at all.
How much of this is about indirection and dishonesty and disinformation, and how much of this is about poor planning and mismanagement? The reason I ask is because I'm thinking back a few months ago, when the Indian government essentially was declaring victory over COVID. In February, the BJP passed a resolution stating, it can be said with pride, India defeated COVID-19 under the able, sensible, committed, and visionary leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In March, they said, we're in the end game. It seemed to me that's partly about political posturing and preparing oneself to advance a narrative. But did they just get this thing wrong, too? Was this also just poor planning and poor management? Did they think they won and actually lost?
It's both. The fact that, you know, when you have an authoritarian regime, which is surrounded by sycophants, who were, as including the health minister and the home minister, who, you know, when the vaccine rollout happened, India was creating this spectacle of Prime Minister Modi being this great world leader who's distributing vaccines to the world. A lot of time and effort went into posturing that Narendra Modi had defeated while the second wave was actually catching up. Last year, COVID-19 had brutally exposed the fact that India's healthcare system had completely collapsed. There are no ventilators in place. The blood banks are running out of blood. One, there is absolutely no planning. One would have forgiven Narendra Modi in 2020 saying, you know, this came out of the blue and we were caught unprepared. What about 2021? How could he be forgiven? And the fact that despite being unprepared, the man goes around and holds election rallies and creates this kind of spectacle of this leader who has defeated something that was fatal to the Indian democracy. You had advertisement placed in the leading newspapers across the country declaring Modi as the leader who has defeated COVID-19. So when you spend so much time posturing, where is the time planning?
Before you go, I wanted to ask you about everyday people who seem to be silenced when they push back against the government's handling of the COVID-19 crisis. The government had Twitter remove 50 posts critical of its handling of the pandemic. You yourself had two tweets deleted. Facebook temporarily blocked content calling on the prime minister to resign. The chief minister of Uttar Pradesh even asked officials to seize the assets of people who spread what he called rumors and propaganda on social media. What does it say to you about India that such a desperate humanitarian issue has been politicized and used as another site of repression, it seems?
I mean, we pride ourselves in calling the world's largest democracy, but we have come across as this morally depraved country which does not even have its basic principles of humanity in place. You know, if the world had a semblance of law and order, Narendra Modi should have been tried for crimes against humanity. But what you see right now is the chief minister of the largest state in India, which comprises of rural India, where every day patients are dying for lack of oxygen. There is devastation. And his only priority is to tell hospitals that you're not putting an SOS message for oxygen. A young boy put out a message on social media yesterday saying, my grandfather is dying, I need oxygen. There was a police case registered against him. What does this say about the Indian democracy? It says that we are somewhere a morally dead nation, especially when it comes to our political class, which has lost all semblance of humanity. There are people trying to help each other out. You know, there are SOS calls. And on the other hand, you have the ruling party putting videos of Mr. Modi's election rallies. They're two Indias. They don't reconcile. This is what Modi has brought us to, this place where these two Indias do not reconcile with each other.
Oh, Rana Ayub, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you so much.
That's our show, and that's also it for this season of Upfront. I want to thank you for joining me, Mark Lamont Hill, and we'll be sure to see you next season.